I need to give a caveat before we get into this text. And the caveat is simply this. I've been greatly influenced by several writers, theologians, pastors regarding today's topic. Today's topic is idolatry. And I want to state from the beginning that I have been greatly influenced with what I'm going to share today from three individuals specifically. One, Martin Luther, the great reformer, Protestant, protester. His sermons, specifically on the Ten Commandments, have been greatly helpful to me in the whole topic of idolatry. Secondly, Dallas Willard has been a great influence on me in some of his earlier writings where within them this topic was included. And Tim Keller, especially in his book, Counterfeit Gods, Prodigal God, and some of the sermons that I've listened to or sat in on. They have greatly influenced me in my thinking, so much so that much of their thinking just simply is my thinking. It oozes out of me. And I want to make sure that I give credit to them on the front end, whether I quote them directly or not. I almost feel like I got to put a quote on the front end of my message and a quote on the back end and just say, everything that I say is theirs. It's pretty close to that. I just want you to know that. I want to give credit where credit's due. I feel more of a conduit. I'm playing the role of a conduit this morning than anything else. And I want to confess that at the beginning. Acts chapter 17. Like I said, keep your thumb there and your forefinger in Acts 19. Earlier this summer, James took us through a text in Acts 17 where we read the following, if you take a look at verse 16. Verse 16, Acts 17 says, "Now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols." And you remember this, if you've been around, this is where Paul gets up in the Areopagus and he preaches, teaches against the idols that were commonly worshipped, talking about the unknown idol, etc., in the city of Athens. But that was not an isolated case. If you hang a left in your Bibles and go back to chapter 14 and look at verse 15, you see something similar take place there as well. Where Paul, along with Barnabas, after being called gods by the people in the town of Lystra, Paul responds and says, "Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news, that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them." In other words, stop worshiping creation and give yourself to the Creator. Stop giving yourself to vain things and give yourself to God Himself. So we see something there like we see in Acts 17. You also see something similar to these events in Acts 16. Where there's the exorcism of the slave girl. I've talked much about various models of ministry seen within the book of Acts, right? I've talked a lot about how one of the things that Acts does is it gives us models of how to do ministry. One of those models that is undeniable in Paul's life is his commitment to calling out against the idols that were indigenous to the places, cultures, times that he lived in which he existed. Paul did this consistently, regardless of the consequences. And some of the consequences were extremely harsh on Paul. And we'll see the same thing in today's text. Now, as we start talking about idolatry, and all this is just premise, it's lead up, I want to give you a definition. When I'm talking about idols or idolatry, what am I talking about? Well, an idol or idolatry is any created thing that takes God's place. Anything in your life that is so central to it that if lost, your life would cease to have meaning. You can't do without it. Anything you value that if taken away, your sense of value, your sense of worth and identity is removed with it. Any and everything, by the way, can become an idol. Some examples, family certainly can become an idol. Children, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Job, your job, achievement, competence, beauty. Right, politics, social success, moral record, religiosity, ministry success, academic excellence, your body, financial achievement, family connections, and so on are all just some examples of idols that are worshipped in our culture, certainly. There are many examples in addition to what we see currently in the Bible. One of the most in-your-face examples of idolatry or an idol in the Bible is the golden calf. Probably is one of those that most of us sort of connect to idolatry, the worship of something like a golden calf or some kind of literal idol that we can put our hands on and see. But there are many other examples that aren't like that, but are certainly idols as well. I think the return, the Galatians who returned to the law that Paul writes about in the book of Galatians, their return to the law was a form of idolatry. The entering into treaties for political security and protection was a form of idolatry. It led to the many wives that individuals in the Old Testament married. Those were marriages of treaty making. We read of many shipwrecking their faith for the deception of wealth in the scriptures. So all of those are forms of idolatry. All of them serve as idols. So to our text, with that out of the way, how does Paul, if he is serving as a model for us in this particular area, how does he confront the idols of the day? Well, here's the first thing that he does. He identifies them, real simply. Take a look back at chapter 17 if you're not there. In verse 22, I just want you to note a couple of really important words. In verse 22, we read that he has perceived their religiosity. If you like underlying things, you can underline that. In verse 16, it says that he saw that the city was full of idols. In verse 23, it tells us that when he walked around the city, he didn't just sort of walk around blindly, but instead his eyes were wide open as I passed along and observed, he said. So we see things like, words like perceived, saw, observed, leading to the identification of what was worship. What were the idols of their culture? Verse 17 tells us that what Paul did and how his ministry was lived out is he would go to the synagogues and he would also go to the marketplace and he would reason with people who had gathered there. Now, what is the marketplace? Well, the marketplace was something larger than just where you went and bought your fruit and veggies. The marketplace is where you hung out. The marketplace is where you took your kids to play. The marketplace is where you met people, had conversation with them. It was a place of debate. Trials were held in the marketplace, debates. If you needed a job, you would go to the marketplace. In other words, the marketplace within the context of what we encounter in the book of Acts was the center, the hub of activity. It was the place where culture was formed. Tim Keller asks in one of his books, what is today's marketplace? In other words, where is culture formed today? Well, Hollywood certainly is a former of culture. Academia is a former of culture. As I've said on occasion, if you want to know a culture's current trend, just go to a local magazine rack and take a look at the covers of the magazines that are on the rack. And what you see there is what we idolize in our culture today. Like Paul, if he identified the culture and what the idols were in it at that time, so too do we need to recognize and identify the idols of our culture. In fact, unless I understand and identify the idols of our culture, my preaching will be useless. In addition, my preaching and teaching will be hindered if I don't grasp the idols in my life, and there are several, and I'll highlight them, that are big bad boy idols in my life. Timothy was instructed by Paul to watch his doctrine and his practice closely, first and foremost, and then things went out from there. But it's not just my task as a preacher, teacher, to understand what's going on in our culture and understand what's going on in my life so my preaching and teaching isn't hindered. But in addition, we all need to recognize the idols in our culture if we're ever going to advise or counsel people usefully. I mean, if you ever go out for a coffee and someone pours their life out, what's going on in my life? If you don't have an understanding of what the idols are in our culture, your counsel and advice to them, like I said, will be useless. In fact, we can't understand moral failings or psychological problems apart from understanding idols. Every issue we have is worship-based. And that's not an oversimplification, but an intensification, for it demands a digging deeper. Unwrapping that layer, getting to that layer, and getting to that layer underneath that one. Verse 16, as you look back to the chapter, tells us that when Paul saw what people were giving themselves to, his spirit was provoked. In our language, he had this God-stirred pit in his stomach when he looked around at the cities that he was doing ministry in. But why? Why was Paul provoked? I think that's a really important question. Why was Paul provoked? Here's the answer. I'll give it to you on the front end, and I will try to convince you later. Paul was provoked because, quite simply, he knew that only the gospel changes lives. That no lasting and genuine change can come apart from the gospel. Only the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. Now, I know when I say that on the front end, some of you need convincing of that. You're like, hey, Norm, no. I disagree with that. I'm not there with you on that. I need to hear more on that. I get that. And I will attempt to do that as I go. But let me say this much at least. Idols promise something that they cannot deliver on. Anything temporal cannot promise the eternal. Anything created can't promise transcendence. And our culture loves transcendence. Anything human cannot promise that which only comes from the divine. The finite cannot offer the infinite. Idols, in other words, cannot save us. Knowing this leads to the second thing that Paul models for us, and that is he shined light on the idols and he preached against them. Now, that is what Acts 17 in Athens is all about. But it wasn't, again, exclusive to just that, which leads to what takes place in Acts 19. We're finally there. Take a look at Acts 19, starting at verse 21. Now, after these events, Paul resolved in the Spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia, and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. And having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. About that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way Christianity was referred to in those days. For a man named Demetrius, the silversmith, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades and said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. And you see and hear that only in Ephesus, not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made without hands are not gods. How do you think that went over? Paul is saying to everybody that the gods we worship and give ourselves to are not gods at all. I mean, Paul was not only calling out their goddess worship, Artemis, he was also highlighting, confronting the idol of money that spawned off of that. So how do they respond? Well, the response is found in verses 27 to 34. Let me read it for you. And there is danger. I don't know why, but why did I say it like that? There is danger. There is danger. Danger. Not only that this trade of ours might come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis, there she is, may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all of Asia and the world worship. When they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So the city was filled with the confusion. And they rushed together in the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in travel. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion and most of them did not know why they had come together. It's fantastic. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander, motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, for about 2 hours, they all cried out with one voice, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. That's how they reacted. Confusion, enragement, crying out, seizing some of Paul's workers. When they saw someone who they thought was on a different team, they just cried out for 2 hours, great is Artemis. It's a dangerous moment. I mean, Paul himself was held back by some of the disciples because it was so dangerous. Don't go in there. I mean, some of Paul's guys were taken from Paul. This is dangerous. Few things are more dangerous than when we call out people's idols. The question that I want to ask that leads into the rest of this text is, if when Paul saw the idolatry around him that his spirit was provoked, how do we respond in our in our own lives to the idols that we have around us? Are we provoked? Do we even have eyes to see the idols in our lives? In our city's lives, in our culture's lives? And to say nothing about the idols in our culture's lives, what are the idols within the church? And if we do see them and we aren't provoked, why? What's going on in our lives? Here's what I want to do with the rest of our time this morning. I want to take the chance of enraging some of us by shining light on three common sets of idols. And I borrow these categories, these three sets of idols from entirely from Keller and Luther. You need to know that as well. What are the three sets of categories, or the category which is encompassed with three sets? Three sets are personal idols. I didn't say that very well. Personal idols, religious idols, and cultural idols. Let's unpack them. I'll try to shed light on them, fill in some of the gaps within these. Number one, personal idols. What are some examples of personal idols? Well, perhaps the most common is money. Perhaps the biggest, most prominent personal idol is money. Paul writes this, Colossians 3:5, and you can read this on the screen. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you: sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, or greed. And then he adds this, which is idolatry. There's our word. Artemis, who we've come across over the last couple of Sundays, the goddess of fertility, she was associated with business, commerce, with people literally going to her temple, offering sacrifices to her with the hope that on the other hand, they would receive more. They would be blessed financially. They would get more stuff. This goes on today. Today we sacrifice much in the hope that we will have more on the other end. Child sacrifice goes on today in North America under the umbrella of our idol of money. Child sacrifice is the norm for many in the longing for more money. Families get sacrificed for this pursuit. Much. Money is a personal idol. Another idol is romantic love. Very prominent. I'm nobody unless this person loves me. If Artemis was the goddess of commerce, Aphrodite, who we've also come across in our study of Acts, was the goddess of love. And she, like Artemis, is worshipped today. Now, here is something that I know we know, but I don't know if we really get it. Do we know that no one person can meet all of our needs? Like, I know we know this, but do we know this? That there's no one person that can meet all of our needs, and when we forget that, we put that expectation on them, and they become gods to us. And marriage doesn't solve this. In fact, the idol of love is only exacerbated in marriage. Because you have the idol of love, you meet someone, you put this godlike status on them, they have to achieve something in your mind, and when they don't, man, it gets fiery. Most of us know, sweet move, most of us know 1 Corinthians, so you think you can dance. 1 Corinthians, I don't actually. 1 Corinthians 13, most of us know, even if you don't think you know, because you've been to a wedding, it's always read there. Love is patient, love is kind, love, you know, keeps no record of wrongs, love is not self-serving, love does not envy, does not boast, not arrogant, so on. Here's the problem with that text. It is not, I'll make this very clear, it is not first and foremost a command to love like that. That's not the purpose, first and foremost, within 1 Corinthians 13. Instead, primarily, it is a text telling us what love is. The primary purpose of 1 Corinthians 13 is to get us to a place where we find the one who can love like that. Who is that? Who loves like that? God. God is class, love. Love is, as it gets laid out in 1 Corinthians 13. Jesus, God in flesh, is the one who is altogether patient, altogether kind, does not envy, boast, is not arrogant, and praise God, keeps no record of wrongs. Love begins there with Jesus. And then once we get to Jesus, Because when we get to Jesus, the love of God is poured out into our hearts by the Holy Spirit, according to Romans 5. When we get to Jesus, 1 Corinthians 13 helps us in our life with Jesus. The problem for many is we want to find a person who will 1 Corinthians 13 us. You know what I mean? And we put that demand on them. That's why people get posters and you put them where they can see it, right? With 1 Corinthians 13 on it. Read that every day. Just read that every day. Make that your goal because that's my expectation of you. Fact of the matter is you won't find anybody who will 1 Corinthians 13 you. And until we get that, we will make an idol out of the idea of romantic love, and we will cling to, and we will possess, and we will idolize, and we will rely on them in unhealthy ways. Our spouse, our boyfriend, or our girlfriend. And if you have all three, you're in trouble, all right? You're in trouble. You call us. We'll counsel you. We're not that church. There are churches in the city where that's okay. We're not one of them. And you're probably going, tell me, where are they? Make my life so much simpler. Here's another idol, personal idol, children. This is where I'm really going to enrage some people, children. This is a big one. For children in our culture, especially the church culture, children have moved from being good to being ultimate. And again, even in the church. This is so weaved into the church culture, we oftentimes miss it. I've heard Christians say, with no sense of question, they'll say something like, my family comes first. My family's first. Okay, think about that statement. Jesus follower, you are saying your family is first. Do I think that your family should be a high priority? Yes. Do I think your family should be first? If they are your God. I think Jesus needs to be first. Oh yeah, Jesus. Oh yeah, that's a given. I mean, when I say my family's first, yeah, geez, obviously, Jesus, he's always first. He's my best friend. Right? He's my homeboy. He's my pilot. Yeah, Jesus, Norm, I'll give you Jesus. Yeah, that's a given. That's a given. But then my family after Jesus. I'll give you that. I agree with you. Jesus first, then your wife, kids, whatever. If you're married and have kids, I get that. Children need to be a priority. However, I think what we give lip service to too often gets lived out in opposing ways. In other words, I think we throw Jesus in there. Yeah, Jesus is first. But when it gets down to the nitty gritty where the rubber meets the road, we live in opposition to that. So many people live lives that revolve around their children. And I'm not talking about time spent, because I know kids take a lot of time. That's one of the mistakes we make when we talk about idolatry, is we equate, well, whatever I give most time to is my idol. That's not true. If that were true, then sleep would be our idols, right? Like, man, wow. And for some of you, it is, right? I get that too, right? Or your job. I think you can work long hours. You can work good, honest, make good, honest living, work just an honest, you know, work week, and that doesn't necessarily mean that your job is your idol. What I'm talking about instead is that many parents whose whole sense of value and worth is wrapped up in what their kids achieve and participate in, with a great need in that to be seen by others as a great parent. You know, I'm all for parents being proud of their children. I have two boys. I'm proud of my boys. What I caution us against is finding our sense of value and worth and identity in them. Do you know why I caution us on this, parents? And parents who are going to be parents one day, soon to be parents, I caution us on this because two things are the result. Number one, it's not fair to your kids for you to deify them. For you to find your worth and identity and value in your kids is not fair to your kids. It leads to two things in your kids, two very opposing things in your kids. One is they become very arrogant and pride-filled. Or It crushes them. It crushes them. Some of you have felt that crush. Your parents' lives has been lived through you, and you've felt that pressure. It's not fair to them, parents. Can't deify our kids. Love on them, encourage them, point them to Jesus, but don't make them your gods. The other reason why we can't make our kids our gods is because it's idolatry for us. I know there's pushback in some of this, but my kids have been entrusted to me. They're eternal. They have souls. They're a heritage. Therefore, they're different. I couldn't agree more. But just as our spouses are have been entrusted to us, and talents that have been entrusted to us, but entrustment doesn't mean that any of them are to be put on a pedestal. See, what I find quizzical a little bit about the discussion of kids in the church with parents is that many parents in the church will hold up the fact that their kids have been entrusted to them by God and they are unique because they do have a soul and they are eternal, yet they pour into them in ways that just suggests the opposite. I see parents in the church who seem to pour into their family, suggesting an idea that all of life is what they can get now. Seemingly not believing the fact that their kids do have a soul and their lives are eternal. See, parents, we need to parent with eternity in mind. Not just what we can see here and now. Another example of idolatry under personal idols, politicians, politics. Many look at civic leaders to serve as their saviors. One of the greatest worship services that I have seen in recent times was the inauguration of Barack Obama. It's a great worship service. And that's not a diss on Barack Obama. I'm not talking about his style, his leadership, his take on things. I'm just talking about some of the language used in connection to him 3 years ago at his inauguration made you wonder if they weren't referring to some kind of deity. It is interesting that we either, with our politicians, we either do two things, demonize them or deify them. You know what I mean? They're either Satan or God. There's kind of no kind of balance. And we need to balance that because they are just people. So those are some examples of some personal idols. Let me push on. Another category are religious idols. One American writer asks this, and I don't mean to pick on our U.S. brethren, but he asks, if 34% of U.S. population claims to be born again, wouldn't Christians be having a bigger impact on society than they do? In contrast to that, he says, look at what's happening in Ephesus in Acts 19. The gospel butted up to the idols of that culture and they impacted it greatly. It is ironic, isn't it, that people in the church mock Bible Belt areas? The people in the church mock areas that have been influenced with belief in God. That is ironic. Some examples of religious idols, truth. Truth can become an idol. I am saved because of the rightness of what I believe. I'm justified because I believe in justification. When in fact you're justified, you're saved because of what Jesus has done alone for you. This idol just raises up doctrinal Pharisees. I'm right, here's why I'm right. In a sense, the superiority right arises. And we can just, again, we can make idols out of the truth. And that's why there needs to be a caution in this, because we need to watch ourselves as we identify other people's religious idols, that we not get puffed up, prideful, arrogant. In the process, we get tempted. That's why I think Paul writes in 2 Timothy 2, this cautionary note about how we're supposed to go about this kind of thing. 2 Timothy 2, please. Thank you. And the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone, able to teach, patiently enduring evil. Okay, that's how we're to do it. Correcting his opponent with gentleness. So we've got how and we've got what. We're to correct, but gently, patiently, so that God may perhaps grant them repentance, leading to a knowledge of the truth. See, ironically, we can oftentimes present the doctrines of grace without a hint of grace, which doesn't help. Some would argue that even attempting to correct anyone in their view of God is arrogant and wrong, right? I mean, who are you to go around trying to correct somebody's view of God, whether done gently and patiently or not? I like a post Brett Landry, one of our apprentices, put on The City, quoting, I think, Tim Keller, where he wrote, saying that it is wrong to say someone else's view of God is wrong. So let me say that again. Saying that it is wrong to say someone else's view of God is wrong is in itself a view of God. So truth and ideology can become idols. Gifts, spiritual gifts can become idols. We can make the mistake. We can mistake spiritual gifts for spiritual fruit, and there is a distinction. This justification leads to, or this idea leads to justification by ministry. There are those who say, I'm justified because I believe the right things. This is the person who justifies themselves by ministry and their participation in it and how things are going. This is my idol. This is what I battle. All too often, my sense of worth, identity, value is wrapped up in how ministry is going. Things go well on Sunday, man, I am the life of the party Sunday afternoon. I'm your buddy, man. I'm your buddy. Things don't go well, snap at my wife, snap at my kids, man. Upset. I've told this story. My first year at Westside, planting Westside, I went home, and during that first three-year period, man, I put three holes in the walls of my home. I was so ticked. I still got a hole in here. See that hole right there? I've showed this before, right? There's a little bit of a hole in there because I punched the wall like backwards like this, and there was a nail there, drove right into my palm. And all my wife did, she looked at me and said, you're so stupid, it serves you right. And I've got, it's my reminder. And my anger came not because there was any, it just simply came, I suck, that sucks, I've killed the church, this place sucks, this is terror, I hate it. I fight this much. This mindset, this sort of gifts mindset, justification by ministry mindset, also leads to the idolizing of people in ministry. This has been going on for 2,000 years. Paul writes about in 1 Corinthians where that church had individuals that said, we're Paul guys and Apollos guys and Peter guys. And then you had the arrogant, it's only me and Jesus guys. I don't listen to anybody else, which in itself becomes idolatrous because really you're the only one that you listen to. And you think you're the only one that things can be filtered through. That's idolatry. So that's why Paul says, hey, all of you Jesus only guys, smarten up. We need to grow in the context of community. But this goes on today where we watch people in ministry and go, boy, I want to teach like them, lead worship like them, counsel like them. I want to write books like them. I want a ministry like them. And they become idols. Styles and philosophies can become idols. Aspects of ministry can become idols. Where we take aspects of ministry that are good and we just make them the ultimate. So some churches become more known for things like their work in the community. That's their identity. Their ecclesiology, how they do leadership, how they do worship. And those things that are good that ministries need to give themselves to, again, become ultimate. And that becomes the golden calf that is worshipped in their church. Morality can become an idol under this. This is legalism and moralism as reflected in the older son and the parable of the prodigal son. Again, to refer to Keller, he unpacks this in The Prodigal God, his book that came out a couple of years back. This is taking moral righteousness and turning it into an idol. This comes out in statements such as, I'm better than you, more serious than you because I don't smoke or drink or am more involved. I'm better than you because I don't watch that, listen to that. I'm better than you because. This is the older son in the story of the prodigal son. I never went away and squandered my inheritance. I've always been faithful here at home. Father, why should we welcome that son of yours back? See, the older son remained at home, yet he was as prodigal as the younger. He had no real sense of sonship. He was still a slave. He was a slave to performance. Here's the last category. It's the category of cultural idols, and boy, this is big. I've talked about the Enlightenment over the years in this ministry. I talked about it in connection with our Easter gatherings this year. The Age of Enlightenment, the modern age, the Age of Reason, the age that suggested that, you know, medicine, education, science, commerce would solve our ills. It was the Age of Reason, human reason, and it made human reason an ultimate thing. Culture elites today make science an idol. It's gone from good to ultimate. They teach that education can solve all our moral problems. Ideologies fall under this. There are people that live their lives by ideologies. It can fall under this. We have certain ideologies that trump everything else. Many put hope in man's ability, but our God's always let us down. Another example of cultural idols is itself the Western culture. The big umbrella ideology of the Western culture, the individual as an idol. My individualism and my feelings are absolute, therefore you can't tell me or you can't tell anybody else they are wrong. We can't offend people. Offending people today is the unpardonable sin. Self-expression can become an idol. Do you know how this gets lived out within, because this has infiltrated the church, individualism as an idol. This is weaved into the church. And you know how it gets lived out very ironically is in two things, ironically. One is community and community groups. Because never has there been a culture that has talked more about community and understood it less. Let me explain what I mean. Just in the context, let's just use the context of Westside and our community groups. I guarantee we will have people that will walk into our community groups. I encourage you to walk in to them. But we'll walk into a community group with the number one reason why they are walking in being, what will this do for me? That's ironic. I'm going to this community group with the number one reason, what will it do for me? Another way this gets lived out in the context of church life is service. You ever heard the expression, I serve because it makes me feel good? I talked about this a little bit with our ministry leaders, right? A lot of people say that. I serve because of how it makes me feel. It makes me feel good. That's not service. It's self-service, but it's not service. Let me ask you a question. Okay, let's dig a little deeper. Let's intensify this. What happens if in your service it didn't make you feel good? Would it still be worthwhile? What happens if your service benefited something bigger than yourself and it didn't make you feel good? Is there a higher purpose than just how you feel? What happens if you go to a community group and it doesn't benefit you at all, but your participation benefits the group? Is it worth it? You know why we resist this? Because again, we become supreme in how we evaluate our participation. And if it no longer benefits me, brother, sister, I'm out of here, man. That's why people jump from church to church to church to church, and relationship to relationship to relationship to relationship. Individual as supreme as idol. I think also in the Western culture, technology. I mean, technology is an idol. Things are taken from good to ultimate. I mean, there are things in our culture, technology-wise, where it is our identity. Where if you were to remove that thing from them and hand them the opposing product, it would really bug them. I mean, I get Apple's the best. Okay, I get that. I get that. I get that. I mean, we all get that. But if somebody took your iPhone away from you and handed you a BlackBerry and you feel like there's a part of your identity going with that, that's a problem. And I kid you not, like, I'm going to laugh about it too, man. But that's a problem. We identify ourselves much with our culture. We even talk about ourselves. Yeah, I'm an apple guy. What do you mean you're an apple guy? What does that mean you're an apple guy? What does that mean? What does that mean? Right? We do a lot of things. So I think technology certainly is one of those things. The environment becomes a god for many people. Things taken from good, hear me on that, to ultimate. I got to close. A couple junk drawer tidbits in this. These have no rhyme or reason. I'm just going to throw them out there because I think they're helpful. Real quick, Martin Luther, the great reformer, protester, leading to the Protestant movement. He wrote and preached that you never break commandments 2 through 10 without breaking the first one first. What is the first one? You shall have no other gods besides me. What are 2 through 10? Well, don't covet, don't lie, don't steal, don't murder, rest, don't commit adultery, and so on. Luther's point, to break any one of those necessitates that you remove God from the throne and break number one first and place yourself there. It's the exchanging of God, as Paul writes in Romans 1, for something created. See, idolatry at its root evidences a lack of trust in God. Why do we lie? Why do we cheat? Why do we steal, covet, not rest, commit adultery? Because we don't trust in the goodness and grace of God. A couple litmus tests to help us test our hearts. Let me ask 3 questions really quickly. Number one, what do you grieve over that you shouldn't? Good way to test your heart. What do you grieve over that you shouldn't, and what don't you grieve over that you should? Let me give you a really simple example. Let's say you're having people over to your house, and you're going to make muffins. Right? Everybody likes muffins. Going to make muffins. Got people coming over. You fire up, work on these muffins, and you burn them. And you freak. And you burnt the muffins. Freaking out. Place smells like smoke. You're ticked. Muffins are ruined. All of that. Okay, why are you reacting, Richter scale 10, to the burning of muffins? Right? Why? Is it because you burnt the muffins, or is there something greater going on? Yeah, there's probably a good chance that you have people coming over and you want to be seen as perhaps a good cook, good at hospitality. You want to be seen as an individual that has your life together. In other words, there is a bigger idol problem going on in situations like that necessitate a digging deeper. Because most of the times we react in ways that to far grander scales than deserve to be reacted. Does that make sense? Sort of. So what do you grieve over that you shouldn't? I mean, most parents, just to pick on the parents again, because I am one. Parents, let me ask you this question. In your parenting, have you ever been out in public with your kid, and your kid has acted up, and you've reacted in such a way that really is over the top compared to how your kid acted out? And the reason why you reacted the way you did to the way your kid is living their lives is simply because other people are observing you, and you want to be seen well? That their action, your kid's action is... That's not a big deal. But because you want to be perceived in a certain way, because you are, man, this is a big deal to you, how you're perceived, you take it out on your kid. So what do you grieve over that you shouldn't, and what don't you grieve over that you should? Here's a second question. Do you get angry that people don't have the same convictions as you? I'm not talking about the essentials of the Christian faith. I'm talking about things under them, like maybe how you parent or how you do relationships or how you do finances or something like that. And instead of finding joy in them and serving God through them, you get upset that people don't follow the same manner of life in those things. Probably a good chance that it's become an idol for you. Have you ever uttered the expression, "I can't forgive myself"? That's another demonstration. It's a demonstration that the real God in your life is your own expectations of you. And perhaps those placed on you by your parents. Oh yeah, I get God forgives me, but I can't forgive myself. It's It's a litmus test. I got to put a bow on this. What do we learn? What do we see? We need to recognize and expose and preach against the idols, both inwardly in our own lives and outwardly in our culture. But note, just note that when we do, it gets dangerous. People get very fired up over this topic. The second thing that we see is that Paul risked his life to break and defeat the power of idols. He risked his life for it. But more importantly, Jesus gave his life to defeat them. He disarmed them and put them to open shame on the cross, as Colossians 2:15 tells us. See, power and principalities unleashed all of their fury on Jesus, and he died. Yet in doing that, he defeated them all. We need to own that, and we need to apply that. We need to have no other gods before him. We cannot serve both God and mammon. And therefore, we must continue to identify, expose, and destroy idols in our own lives and help others to do the same. See, Westside, can I just close with a couple of questions? Why serve that which does not fulfill what it promises? Like, why serve that? And why worship that which cannot save? Would you rise as we respond, please? Thanks.